You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 152, Ezekiel, chapters 38 and 39, part 1. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty good. Having a good week. I am pug sitting this week. We have a second pug in the house, so it's awesome.
How's that going? They like each other? Are they friends?
They do. They do. They're friends. The new one has this odd habit of perching himself on the top of the corner of the couch, and he'll just sit there like and stare at everyone.
I think we've started.
I don't know what's up with that.
I think we started a trend in our Facebook group. People have been posting your Reverse and Hermon book with their animals, chickens and other dogs. And so
great.
I think we've got a.
Yeah.
So if you've got an animal you want to post with Reverse and Hermon book, go for it.
There you go. There you go.
Maybe you could do the same because you're two pugs and you sit in between.
We're planning on getting a picture of me with both pugs. Trust me. That'll show up somewhere. Today was his first full day. They brought him over yesterday. So his name is Bruno. So Bruno and Maury are they're in control of the house right now. Having a good week, yeah.
Well, good. Well, Mike, I'm excited about this week and the next week. I know eschatology is not your favorite, but it's just so hard to get away from in the Bible. It's everywhere. So I think you should start to just embrace it.
Not so much.
Not so much. But you can't escape it. It's everywhere and ever more present in the next two episodes.
Well, I would be, I'll be unkind and say it's imagined in more places than it is, but I'll admit that it's a big deal. So I just don't like the popular takes on it. And we're going to get one of those, in this part. So one of the reasons we're doing two parts on this is today in this episode, it's kind of a nuts and bolts episode. This is chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel. It's the Gog from the land of Magog. Prophecy. It is a prophecy. It was forward looking. But again, we have this question, as always in the Old Testament, and in particular the prophets, how forward looking is this? Was it like 10 years, 100 years later, or is it like future in our time and even future to our time? A lot of people who are, quote, into prophecy, unquote, assume the latter, but that, really isn't always the case. Well, chapters 38 and 39, we are going to get some stuff, that I would think of as really, true eschatology, end time stuff, even in relationship to us. But, it has a very has very clear connections to known history in the Old Testament period, known places, known terms. And that's going to matter because in this first part, again, I said it's kind of the nuts and bolts episode, part one of two. We're going to talk about the terms, Gog, Magog, Tubal, Meshech, Togarma, all those sorts of things, and what they point to, what they mean, and that's going to be naturally a setup, but a really important framework, setting the stage for the second part, which will be focused on interpretation. So part one, again, nuts and bolts, who are we talking about, what do the terms mean, and then the second part will be more interpretation. But even though this first part is essentially word study and geography and all that sort of thing, I think listeners will actually find it quite interesting. Now, since we are dealing with two chapters and we're going to have two parts, for this episode, I'm just going to read the first few verses of each chapter, chapter 38, chapter 39 of Ezekiel, because that's where we get our terminology from. And we'll read through that, and then we'll just start drilling down into some of the words, some of the places that are used, and talk about what they mean and what they don't mean. So jumping in here with chapter 38, we'll start in verse 1, and again, I'm reading from ESV. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, set your face toward Gog, of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in full armor, a great host, all of them with buckler and shield, wielding swords, Persia, Cush, and Put, are with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all his hordes, Beth Togarmah, from the uttermost parts of the north, with all his hordes, many people are with you. Now that's the first six verses of chapter 38. The more obvious terms here, Persia, Cush, Put is Libya. Again, we're not so much worried about them. I'm worried about the ones that are from the north. Those particular places are not northern locations. Because again, I want to set up part two when we talk about interpretation. And we'll pick up, you know, some of these other ones in part two as well. So we're concerned with Meshech, Tubal, Gog, Magog, Gomer, these sorts of things, because they're going to be references to northern places. Now, before I read a few verses in chapter 39, did you notice, and we're not going to talk about this today, but for the next part, did you notice this description? I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws. Okay. That might ring a bell with some other things we've talked about, some other mytho-poetic things we've talked about that will be important, again, I think, for properly understanding why we get this description and why it's important when we're talking about a northern enemy, an enemy from Tsafon, which is the mythic north, the place, the bad place, the place where Baal had held dominion, you know, the rival gods and all that sort of stuff. That description, I'm not going to tell you, you know, precisely what I'm thinking here, but turning you about, putting hooks into your jaws, if you look that up in the Bible, you'll find some interesting references, again, that go along with a, you know, a mythic approach to certain biblical theological ideas. That's about all I can say, and that's the way I have to say it, so that I don't, you know, spill the beans here before we get to part two. But anyway, just to set your mind in motion there. Then we go to chapter 39, and we read, "And you, son of man, prophesy against Gog and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn you about and drive you forward and bring you up from the uttermost parts of the north and lead you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will strike your bow from your left hand and will make your arrows drop out of your right hand. You shall fall on the mountains of Israel, you and all your hordes and the peoples who are with you. I will give you to birds of prey of every sort and to the beasts of the field to be devoured. You shall fall in the open field, for I have spoken, declares the Lord. I will send fire on Magog and all those who dwell securely in the coastlands, that they shall know that I am the Lord." Couple things here to prep you for part two. Again, the description of, I will give you to the birds of prey of every sort, and to the beasts of the field to be devoured, and then the sending fire. Again, I'm not going to say any more about that, but just if you want to prep yourself for part two, go look some of that stuff up in your Bible and you'll find some interesting things. Now, we read those two sections of each chapter, and our focus here is identifying these northern enemies, these terms. So the identification of Gog in Ezekiel 38 and 39, again, this is no secret, has proven to be one of the most vexing problems in Old Testament study, really in biblical studies. The textual situation is pretty chaotic, and it's chaotic in meaning that when here you are in the 6th century with Ezekiel, okay, this is when the book is going to be composed. It, you know, might undergo some editing. We've talked about that before, but it's pretty close to the beginning of the second temple period. You know, you're less than 100 years away from getting a second temple. The first one was destroyed. And in the second temple period, there's lots of speculation. There's lots of opinion about what in the world Ezekiel is describing here. And people, Jews writing in the second temple period, are all over the place. And they're not only all over the place, but they actually misread, and I'm going to show you a few examples of this later, they misread certain terms in the text, like Gog, Gog. You'll believe it or not, the Septuagint, for instance, which was produced in the second temple period, sometimes substitutes Og, you know, the Og of Bashan, you know, the giant Og of Bashan. It's not spelled the same way, but that's the way they'll render it in their translation when no Hebrew text says that. And it shows you that they don't know who this Gog is, but hey, this one sounds kind of close. Maybe it's the same guy, so let's put him in there. They'll do stuff like that in the Septuagint and in other Second Temple texts. So if you actually look at the situation of Jews in antiquity trying to figure this out, it's kind of a mess. You know, it's sort of a free for all. We'll get into more of that next time, but just so that you're prepped here, because when we go through the terms here, what I just told you is going to matter a little bit. Now, everybody essentially would agree that Gog was or will be an eschatological enemy. You know, he either was, again, subsequent, you know, to the time that Ezekiel's writing, or this is something still yet future. It's some kind of future foe relative to Ezekiel's time. Everybody agrees with that. There's disagreement, though, with how the figure can be associated with either a historic figure, historic enemy, or an Antichrist figure, or whether even Gog should be associated with the Antichrist. There's disagreement among scholars on all those things. Scholars have pursued several options for identification. So let's just start there with sort of trying to get a historical alignment here of some type. And, you know, spoiler alert, this has not been successful, but I'm going to go through a couple of the options. Now, the dominant interpretive strategy tries to take the geographic places named in Ezekiel 38 and 39, places like Meshech and Tubal, and then look through historical sources where those place names occur, and then look just to try to find a tyrant candidate or some sort of warlord candidate to hopefully identify who in the world Ezekiel's talking about here when he starts talking about Gog. I have a quote here from Johann Lust, that's L-U-S-T. This is from DDD, Dictionary of Deities and Demons in the Bible, and this is part of his entry on Gog. He writes, "In an attempt to identify Gog as a historical person, attention has been drawn to a city prince, Gogi, mentioned in the annals of Ashurbanipal, specifically Cylinder B, Section 4, Line 2, a powerful ruler of a belligerent mountain people not far to the north of Assyria." So you get a northern orientation there. More frequently, though, Gog is identified with Gyges or Gyges, G-Y-G-E-S, also spelled Gugu in the Rassam cylinder. Again, this is cuneiform material. The king of Lydia. Okay. Note, however, that the Gog of Ezekiel has the Cimmerians or Gomer as his ally, whereas the same Cimmerians, that's C-I-M-M-E-R-I-A-N-S, not Sumerians, but the Cimmerians. Those Cimmerians appear to have attacked and defeated Gyges of Lydia. So the ones who are supposed to be the allies of Gog in Ezekiel 38 and 39 are the enemies of this particular historical figure. And so this particular historical figure can't really be the identification for Gog. It doesn't work. Lust continues, "Such data suggests that Gog can hardly be identified with Gyges. Alternatively, Gog has been said to be the name of a country, Gaga or Gagaya, allegedly mentioned in the El Amarna letters." Let's just stop here. The Tel El Amarna letters, this was correspondence between the Egyptian pharaoh and his underlings in Syria, Palestine, in the New Kingdom, just call it 1200 BC or so. So that correspondence, even though it was from an Egyptian to people living in Syria, Palestine, the language of the correspondence was Akkadian, because Akkadian used to be what English is today. It was the lingua franca. It was the language of international correspondence. So in the El Amarna letters, the Tel El Amarna letters, we have a reference to Gaga or Gagaya. Lust again continues, "It has become clear, however, that the writing, the Akkadian writing, Ishten Kor Gagaya, is erroneous. It should be Ishten Kor Gagaaska Ya." That's a mouthful. "Which translates one Kash Kian. So this identification must be abandoned as well." In other words, what they thought referred to this Gagaya place actually refers to a different person or a different place. So it doesn't work. And that's the end of Lust's quote. Now, I gave you that, again, basically because, you know, scholars have tried to identify Gog with a historical figure. They find similar sounding names, both for a person and also for a land. That's going to be relevant as we go on. You know, Gog might have something to do with a land as well. So historians, biblical scholars have found these sorts of things in material that is geographically overlapping. Again, this is Mesopotamia. Ezekiel's in Babylon. This is to the north of, you know, Israel. So it's the right context, or at least it you know, could be, it's an option, you know, for fulfilling the context here. But none of the identifications have worked. They all have serious problems. And in some cases, scholars just know now that that just isn't going to work. It's just wrong. But you'll find these things, you know, in older literature. But you know, currently, nobody is claiming with any amount of certainty, or even half amount of certainty, that they know who Gog is. So that's a problem. Now, there are other problems aside from not having a historical match to Gog with identifying Gog. And we'll get to those in a moment. So we'll return to the problem in a bit. But I want to take a look now at the geographical terms, because honestly, they're just a lot easier. And then we'll go back to the Gog reference. So Tubal, Meshach, and Magog are listed elsewhere in the Old Testament among the sons of Japheth. That's Genesis 10, verse 2. This is, of course, part of the Table of Nations. Togarma is also listed in the same Table of Nations in the very next verse, Genesis 10, 3, as one of the sons of Japheth in the Table of Nations. So Genesis 10 sort of certifies, makes it clear what geographical region Ezekiel has in mind when he starts writing about the hordes from the north. And he gives these names: Tubal, Meshach, Magog, Gomer, Togarma. These are all situated and knowable and, again, discoverable in contemporary ancient material. And it's all consistent. This is what, just getting a little ahead of myself here. What you're going to find is that all of these place names are in what used to be called Anatolia or Asia Minor. And again, you know, that if you think of your geography, and we're going to post a map for this particular episode. You know, I pull out some images from the internet and just put them in a PDF so that you can see, you know, maybe follow along even now. But this region, again, Asia Minor, Anatolia, this is to the east of Greece and the Greek Isles, which is obviously north of Israel. It is what is today modern Turkey for the most part. And in the northeast quadrant of that, you're going to have the Black Sea. So the Black Sea is kind of on top of this region. But all of these places are knowable and discernible. Now, to make that point, just so that you don't have to take my word for it, I'm going to read some excerpts from the Anchor Bible Dictionary. All of them, these are entries on all these place names, all of them are written by David Baker, who is a guy I know. David is an evangelical scholar, so if any of you might be listening to this episode in the future, you know, most of my audience is going to know already. I don't think this has anything to do with Russia, you know, or communism or anything like this. And they're going, well, you're just saying that because, you know, you're a liberal or your sources are liberal. No, not so much. David Baker is an evangelical, you know, high view of scripture like any other evangelical. So, you know, we can get that out of the way and dispense with that sort of red herring kind of, you know, comeback. But I want to read a few excerpts here from Anchor Bible Dictionary in the essays that David wrote. We'll start with Tubal. Tubal was one of the seven sons of Japheth, Noah's son, according to the Table of Nations, Genesis 10:2, and the parallel genealogy in 1 Chronicles 1:5. Descendants of Tubal and his siblings, who are listed in the Table of Nations as Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Meshach, and Tiras, are located to the north of Israel in Greece or Asia Minor and north Syria, so all that region there. It's logical, therefore, to expect to find Tubal in the same north area. Tubal is mentioned six further times in the prophets. Isaiah 66:19 speaks of the distant location to which Yahweh will send messengers of his grace. They include Greece, which is Yavan and Tubal, as well as Lud, drawers of the bow. Lud, or the Lydians, in West Turkey and Greece, is the only name in the context with a descriptive epithet. Rather than seeing it as such, the Septuagint revocalizes it and reads Meshach, which is really bizarre. That's my comment there. One of the brothers of the forefathers of Tubal in the genealogies. This fits well with the other prophetic references to Tubal, in which Meshach is always found, but again, it textually doesn't make any sense. These other references include an oracle against Tyre in which trade relations between the two and Tyre include their provision of slaves and instruments of bronze. That's Ezekiel 27. Herodotus mentions two nations, the Moschkoi and the Tibarinoi, and Josephus writes of Thebel and Messenians or Meskenians in his book in the Antiquities. Older Akkadian texts mention Tabal and Mushki. These are located, all of these names by different sources, are located in East Asia Minor. Tabal occupies the territory south of the Halys River to the west of Togarma. Okay, that's the end of what I'll read with about David's entry on Tubal. Notice, and here's the point, all of these place names, even though they differ, you can obviously hear the phonetic similarity. And if we were looking at text, you could see the similarity in spelling. All of them are knowable and discoverable in ancient material, and we know what region it is. Okay, Greek Isles, moving to the east, Asia Minor, Anatolia, north Syria, and to the further north, you hit the ceiling of the Black Sea. Okay, it's a known place. It's a known region, and these are known place names. Okay, and I'm mentioning that for a specific reason that's going to come up. Meshech, David writes, Meshech is one of the seven sons of Japheth, Noah's son according to the Table of Nations in Genesis 10:2, and again the parallel genealogy in 1 Chronicles 1:5. The latter genealogy also lists another person with the same name as a son of Shem, that's in 1 Chronicles 1:17. In the Table of Nations, however, Genesis 10:23, there is no second listing for Meshech, but there is a Mosh, son of Aram, in the parallel position to the Meshech of 1 Chronicles 1:17. This could be a scribal error in which the last Hebrew letter of Meshech was dropped off. That's what the Septuagint seems to be translating. Mosh could also be an entirely different entity, and we don't know. Whatever the case regarding the name in Genesis, the Chronicles genealogy indicates two ethnically distinct groups, one of Semitic and one of non-Semitic descent. Most references to Meshech in the Old Testament are to the non-Semitic peoples. Five times in Ezekiel, they are associated with Tubal. I should stop here. What he means by non-Semitic is that they're descended from Japheth and not Shem. Okay. In Ezekiel 27:13, Meshech and Tubal, along with Javan, Greece, traded slaves in bronze with Tyre, the capital of Phoenicia. Akkadian sources from as early as Tiglath-Pileser, circa 1100 BC, mentioned Meshech, or the Mushkaya, from the land of Mushku. These people paid tribute to Ashur-Nasirpal II, circa 882 BC, from their capital city in East Asia Minor. This tribute included goods of bronze, again noting Ezekiel 27:13. At the end of the 8th century, the king of Meshech was Mita, the famous Midas, whose touch, according to legend, would turn everything to gold. In a letter to Sargon II, dated circa 709 BC, Midas, this Mita, ruler of the land of Muski, seeks a peaceful relationship with the Assyrians. Both Herodotus and Josephus place Meshech, the Moschkoi, in East Asia Minor. The latter locates these people in the area later known as Cappadocia. Again, that's East Asia Minor. Herodotus equates them with the Phrygians somewhat farther west in Asia Minor. Again, you could look at the map for all these references. These people migrated eventually from Eastern Europe into Asia during the 12th century BC. Some of the people of Meshech seem to have moved even farther east around the Black Sea. Now, I'm going to stop here and say this reference to the Black Sea and some of these people groups, this is what the old Gog must be, the Russians. Okay, they'll seize on the Black Sea idea because the Russian boundary touches the Black Sea. Well, if you'll actually look at the map, all these place names, again, I hope that you're not getting sick of me repeating this, but all of these places, again, are in Asia Minor. Asia Minor is underneath the Black Sea. Russia is above the Black Sea. The reference to the Black Sea that some of these peoples, migrated near the Black Sea doesn't mean that they went to like Leningrad, okay, where that is, or Moscow or Stalingrad or something like that. It doesn't mean that at all. So it's dishonest, and it's geographically disingenuous to take references in these reference works like Anchor Bible Dictionary or a map and sort of play fast and loose with the geography. We're not talking about Russia here. We're talking about Anatolia, Asia Minor, East Asia Minor, Northern Syria. These are known places from contemporaneous primary texts. Okay, Magog, let's move on to that term. In the Table of Nations, this appears, Genesis 10:2 again, and the parallel genealogy again, 1 Chronicles 1, verse 5. Magog is one of the six grandsons of Noah through his son Japheth. Others of this line are associated with Asia Minor. Javan, Tubal, Meshech. So a location for Magog also in this area is quite logical. Not all of the listed allies to the north of Israel, however, are to the north of Israel, though. As we pointed out when we read Ezekiel 38, some of them are in other parts, Persia, you know, Libya, Put, all that sort of thing. So they're not all from the north. So, you know, we can't, you know, necessarily say that all of the bad guys are associated with the north. Again, that's quite obvious if you read, you know, Ezekiel 38 and 39. Ezekiel 39:6, David Baker continues, foretells judgment on Gog, which will include fire falling on Magog as well. And also in chapter 39, the fire falls upon the, quote, island dwellers. Now, this is my comment here. Island dwellers would be quite consistent with Javan, Greece, same section of the Table of Nations, same geographical region. Again, even an obscure reference like island dwellers, we know, again, where that geographically makes sense in relationship to all the other places. Continuing with David's entry on Magog, scholars suggest several different locations for Magog, again, as a place name. Skinner, in the International Critical Commentary on Genesis, assumed the identity of Magog and Gagaya, which was mentioned in the Loost quotation, which are mentioned in the Amarna letters. Again, Loost, his little snippet that we read earlier, pointed out that the cuneiform evidence turned out to not be right there. But Baker mentions it here. He says Magog, again, can be identified or has been tried to be identified in a general way as the people from, again, the north, just some vague reference to the north. A more popular identification is that Gog is a Hebrew adaptation on the name of the Lydian king Gyges, which we mentioned as well. And again, Baker's going to go along and say, well, you know, these are all possibilities that have been suggested. Nobody's persuaded. They all have problems, so on and so forth. Now, a note on Josephus here that David brings up. Josephus understood Magog to refer to the Scythians, while the Targum, one of the Targums, Targum Neophiti, interpreted the name as Germania. This is possibly Germanica of Commagene in, surprise, surprise, East Asia Minor. So again, I point this out to say that even, again, in ancient sources, now we're getting into Targums, okay, and Josephus sort of editorializing on what he thinks the term means. Even when you get that kind of material, what they reference is in the same region, okay? East Asia Minor, Asia Minor, used to be known as Anatolia, the, you know, Greek Isles, Northern Syria, that part of the world. And again, that is very consistent. It's completely consistent with the Table of Nations in Genesis 10:2 and verse 3. Moving on to Togarma. Togarma, according to the Table of Nations, Genesis 10:3 and the parallel genealogy in 1 Chronicles 1:6, is one of the three sons of Gomer. So Togarma, again, one of the three sons of Gomer, who himself is a son of Japheth, Noah's son. Again, very consistent. His descendants, or at least those called by the same name, are mentioned twice in the book of Ezekiel in an oracle against Tyre, and of course our Ezekiel passage. Now, Beth Togarma, also, you know, again translated the house of Togarma, is described as exchanging war horses and draft horses and mules with Tyre for her merchandise in Ezekiel 27. The geographical location for other trading nations from the same biblical context, Ezekiel 27 now, verses 1 through 13 lists a lot of these same places. Okay, the geographical location of all of them is consistent. We have Greece, we have Meshech, we have Tarshish, we have Tuval. Again, the Tarshish there, for those interested, You know, Tarshish is actually in Spain, which the Unseen Realm gets into. This is a different use of the term Tarshish. If you wanted a bibliographic reference for that, again, why we have a Tarshish here as opposed to the Tarshish that is in Spain, I have a really nice one. John Day, in his book on Genesis 1:11, has an article specifically on this. So if you were interested, if you had the Divine Council bibliography, you could get that. I do reference it in Unseen Realm, so you can get the reference there. Neo-Assyrian texts, back to David Baker and Togarma. Neo-Assyrian texts apparently refer to this location as Tilgarimu, which is on the east border of Tuval. Sennacherib campaigned against this city in 695 BC. Hittite texts refer to a city and district of Tagarama in the area of the upper Euphrates, which was captured by Supiluliumas, along with other parts of the kingdom of Mitanni. Again, this is the same geographical region. You just look it up on a map. The Assyrian and Hittite sources apparently refer to the same site, which has been identified with the modern Gorun. By the way, the Hittite Empire was focused in Anatolia, Asia Minor. Again, the same place. It's all very consistent. Now, you're probably getting a little bored, you know, with this now, but there's a point. There's a point to all this. The point is, this ain't a mystery. These terms are not mysterious. These terms have nothing to do with Russia as we know it. Now, some are likely to wonder at this point, well, what about Rosh? You know, my translation has, you know, Gog, the Prince of Rosh. You skipped Rosh and all that list of countries and lands. What about Rosh? You know, you're cheating, Mike. Well, actually, no, I'm not. Gog is not the Prince of Rosh. That is a mistranslation. We'll comment on in a few minutes. There are a number of reasons that it's a mistranslation, but among them is the fact that there is no such place name in any ancient text. There is no place name Rosh known in the ancient world. Period. It's not a place name. Rosh is not a place. As Michael Astor has noted, the closest geographical correlation that could be argued is Rashi or Arashi in Neo-Assyrian records, a district on the border of Babylonia and Elam. But as Astor comments, this has nothing in common with Meshech and Tubal. Yeah, he's correct. It doesn't. It's in a different geographical region further to the east, the southeast, in fact. It doesn't point to Russia. That would be far north, okay, north of the Black Sea. Again, the point being made, nobody in the ancient world knew of a place name Rosh. It is not a place name. Now, that's contrary, I know, to what a lot of listeners, you know, may have heard. Listeners may, you know, have heard that Gog is the Prince of Rosh and that Rosh is Russia. I've posted an article with this episode that is also a little bit of a setup, at least kind of get the lay of the land for, you know, the battle of the King of the North and Daniel that we'll be bringing into discussion in part two. But the article posted on the episode page for this episode is by Paul Tanner, and he talks about the invader from the North. The subtitle of his article is, Do we owe Russia an apology? And it's like, yeah, we do. But that article is kind of nice because it takes you through how the Russia idea was popularized by evangelical dispensational interpreters. And he points out some of the problems with it. He doesn't point out all of them. Other scholarly sources will, you know, beat that dead horse despite the fact that it's dead. You should know as a listener, the idea that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is about Russia or a Russian invasion has literally no merit in terms of exegesis. And it has no precedent in terms of a place name in the entire ancient world. It's a fabrication. It's a Cold War hermeneutic. Okay, the Russia idea became popular in the 70s. I remember reading it in prophecy books as a teenager, a new Christian. The bad guys, you know, for the end of the world in the Cold War era, you know, that they were Russians. And the prophecy, quote-unquote, experts, the prophecy pundits of the 70s and 80s that wanted the end times to be imminent right around the corner. Well, who's the enemy? Who's the logical enemy? Well, it's the Russians. Oh, Russia, Rosh, there we go. That's about all the thought that went into it. It is not a view that is based in primary source material and even coherent. Let's say a little bit more about it, though. Now, despite the fact that you've heard this, and again, there's no ancient place name Rosh, there are other problems. Yamauchi, who actually has a good book, you know, for this subject matter, his book is entitled Foes from the Northern Frontier, Invading Hordes from the Russian Steppes, okay? Now, his book isn't about Ezekiel 38 and 39. It's about just what it says. Ancient peoples of the Northern Frontier. Yamauchi is a historian. I think he's still teaching. He's an evangelical. He does a lot of work on Persia in the Bible, Africa in the Bible. Here he's doing these northern countries, you know, Asia Minor and further north. And he, in this book, he does tackle the Russia interpretation and basically slays it, you know, because it's not very hard to do. Again, he's a historian at the University of Miami at Ohio. Might be a familiar name to you because he's been around for quite a while. But Yamauchi points out in his study of the geography, the place name Rosh would have had no meaning to an ancient Hebrew audience since, quote, the name Rus, R-U-S, was first brought to the region of the Kiev. Again, that's right around the Black Sea there. First brought to the region of the Kiev by the Vikings in the Middle Ages. In other words, you don't even find Rus, R-U-S, earlier than the Vikings. So for an ancient person of the biblical period, talking about a place name Rus or Rosh would have been utterly meaningless to them. Going even further, Rus, R-U-S, and the longer Russia, Yamauchi said, you know, notes. Again, I'm basing this on Yamauchi's material here. Rus and Russia are Indo-European words, while Hebrew is from the Semitic language family. Consequently, a Rosh-Russia equation is a linguistic fallacy. It's a false etymology. Additionally, aside from Genesis 10's placement of Meshech and Tubal in Anatolia, Ezekiel's own description of these same places in Ezekiel 27, verses 12 through 15, have them located among the nations adjacent to Anatolia. The place names are thus not the Russian cities, but ancient ethnic groups firmly situated in the ancient Near Eastern geographical reality of the Hebrew Bible. I want to talk about this fallacy a little bit. You know, this shouldn't be earth-shaking, but I know a lot of people are exposed to well-meaning but really poor Bible teaching in this section, and just teaching about biblical languages in general that's really poor. The same set of sounds in one language that form a word do not equate to either the same word in another language or a word that sounds the same that has the same meaning as the first word. Now, in other words, that's a little convoluted. Let me illustrate the point. Chin and chin in English and Chinese, respectively, don't mean the same thing. Even though they sound the same, they don't mean the same thing. So Rosh and Russia, even though they sound the same or very similar, don't mean the same thing. Chin in English, of course, is the, according to Webster, the lower portion of the face underneath the lower lip and including the prominence of the lower jaw. In Chinese, chin means gold or metal or money, something bright. Okay? Completely different because they're different languages. The human mouth and tongue and lips and palate, you can only make so many sounds. Linguists will tell you there's 30 or so that you can make. And since every human being speaks, they have their own language, they're going to use the same set of sounds. But what they mean by the sounds that they articulate is not transferable from one language to the next. And you think, well, Mike, who in the world would think that? Oh, trust me. Trust me. A lot of, quote, Bible teachers are making arguments like that in this passage. It's just absurd. It's absurd. But a couple other ones. Again, coal in Hebrew, K-O-L is the transliteration, and coal in English, C-O-A-L, guess what? They don't mean the same thing. Okay, kol in Hebrew is a word that means all or every or whole. And kol, of course, in English is a black lump of rock, okay? Bar in Aramaic, transliterated B-A-R, is not the same as bar in English. Okay, bar in Aramaic means son. Okay, Simon bar Jonah, Simon, son of Jonah. Bar in English could be like an iron rod, could be a place where you drink alcohol. Okay, it just doesn't mean the same. And I know it sounds ridiculous that I have to spend time explaining something that is so obvious. But what I'm telling you is you'll actually find, not just on the internet, in the wacky world of internet Bible study, but you'll find it in books. You'll find arguments, you know, by things that have been published, not just self-published stuff, but published, you know, by actual real publishers. They're not academic places, but, you know, they exist to publish books. You'll find this kind of stuff in them. And it's utterly absurd. It's nonsense. They're just linguistic fallacies. You know, I think I've been blunt to this point, but I'll be even more blunt, okay? And those of you who are out there listening, yes, you can quote me. Show me someone who does exegesis by matching sounds between languages and then saying the words mean the same thing. And I'll show you someone who doesn't understand either exegesis or languages at all. Okay. There's just there's no merit to this approach. Now let's go back to the actual phrase though, in Ezekiel 38 and 39, that some want to translate Prince of Rosh. The phrase is Nasi Rosh. Nasi is the word for prince. Rosh, again, is another noun. It can mean head or chief or something like that, some high status. There are two options grammatically that can be defended, you know, according to the rules of Hebrew grammar for this phrase. Option number one is Gog, the prince, comma, the chief. In other words, Nasi and Rosh are functioning appositionally. There are two ways of talking about the same person. Gog, the prince, the chief of Meshech and Tubal. That's the one like people like Dan Block, you know, prefer. It has a lot of merit to it. I think it's this most straightforward way to go. It has a nice actual parallel at least the parallel for the idea in 1 Chronicles 7:40. In English it says, "All of these were men of Asher, heads of fathers' houses, approved mighty warriors, chiefs of the princes. Their number enrolled by genealogies for service in war." So this idea of chiefs and princes, again, are their rank terms that have some relationship to each other. Okay, that might be the best way to understand this. Gog, who's Gog? Well, he's the chief. He's the prince. He's the prince and the chief of Meshech and Tubal. So Rosh there is not a place name in that option. Number two, Rosh is not a place name here either. Again, because there was no place Rosh in the ancient world. You could translate it this way: Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. So you would take prince as, you know, they're both nouns, but you would take one as functioning adjectivally. Okay, in this case, the word Rosh, chief prince. Now Rosh functions adjectivally in other places. There are places that refer to the high priest. It's the Kohen HaRosh. Okay, so Rosh, again, even though it's a noun, it can function adjectivally very, very easily, very well, and does so in the Hebrew Bible. So this is another good option. Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And of course, your first option was Gog, the prince, the chief of Meshech and Tubal. Either one of those works according to the rules of Hebrew grammar. Rosh is not a place name. Russia has nothing to do with this. Okay. Now, in my book, Reversing Hermon, I discuss how the Septuagint really is no help with any of this. Now, I hesitated to even bring this into the episode because, you know, it may or may not translate well to audio, but I'm gonna read this excerpt from Reversing Hermon just because I don't want anybody listening to this episode thinking, "Oh, well, Mike, the answer here is the Septuagint. The Septuagint, you have Russia as a place name and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And Gog, you know, Gog is a giant and all this sort of stuff." All right. Well, that isn't true, even though if you get Reversing Hermon and you read the chapter, it's chapter 11, about the connections of the Book of Revelation back to the Watcher story and back to the giants, there is a conceptual connection between the eschatological enemies, including the Antichrist, to Gog and also to giants. Okay, that's valid, at least, you know, in terms of there were ancient Jews who thought in those terms, and I give you all the data for that in the book. But it's not true to base that on the words of Ezekiel 38. So I'm just going to read this, and you're going to see how confused the Septuagint translators were when it came to these names. And, you know, I'm not blaming them. I'm not picking on them. Some of them might deserve a little criticism because they basically just changed the text. But others, you know, are just confused, and they make mistakes. You know, they're humans. You know, that just happens. So here's what I wrote in part of that chapter in Reversing Hermon. The Septuagint translator of Ezekiel also misunderstood the grammatical limitations of Nasi Rosh, leading to several mistakes in translation. In Numbers 24:7, part of the Balaam oracle, the traditional Masoretic Hebrew text reads, Jacob's king shall be higher than Agag, that's A-G-A-G, Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. That's the statement. The point is that Israel's, eventually the Davidic king, Israel's king, will defeat the king of his enemies. In this case, a reference to Agag of the Amalekites in 1 Samuel 15. But the Septuagint, created long after the days of Samuel and Agag, does something quite surprising with this passage. Instead of the phrase higher than Agag, and the Hebrew there is mem, Aleph, Gimel, Gimel, M, Aleph, GG. The Septuagint says this, believe it or not, his kingdom shall be higher than Gog. The effect of this odd translation is to transform the prophecy of Balaam into a remote end times prophecy, pitting Gog against David's Messiah, the Davidic Messiah, as opposed to an Israelite king having victory over Agag in the early days of Israel's history that we actually get in 1 Samuel 15. How are we to understand this dramatic difference between the traditional text, the Masoretic text, and the Septuagint? The Septuagint translation is only textually explainable if the Hebrew text being used by the Septuagint translator read Mem, Gimel, Vav, Gimel, M-G-W-G, instead of the Masoretic texts, Mem, Aleph, Gimel, Gimel. So it had to be a different text. That would explain it. However, it is more likely that the Septuagint translator may have been confused by Mem, Aleph, Gimel, Gimel, and invented from Gog as a translation solution. You know, so it could be a different text, or he could have just made it up. The reason that confusion seems to be the best answer to the odd situation in Numbers 24:7 is that the Septuagint translator clearly blunders elsewhere with respect to Gog. Again, the Septuagint was translated by more than one person, so I'm not saying it's the same translator in the passages that I'm going to refer to next. But what it does show is that the people doing the Septuagint translation found the Mem, Aleph, Gimel, Gimel in Numbers 24:7 difficult to deal with. They didn't quite know what to do with it. And in other places, they had problems. So here we go. Here are some other examples of really odd kind of blunders in the Septuagint. Now, in Amos 7:1, we read this. This is what the Lord God showed me. Behold, he was forming locusts when the latter growth was just beginning to sprout. And behold, it was the latter growth after the king's mowings, like grass clippings, mowings. The Hebrew there is Gimel, Zion, Yod, three letters. Now, the Septuagint translates that, what I just read, this way. Thus the Lord showed me, and behold, an early offspring of grasshoppers coming, and behold, one locust larva, Gog, the king. I mean, it's just so different. Gog is Gimel, Vav, Gimel. It'd have to be a different text than the word in the Masoretic text. Now, Lust, Johann Lust, which I referenced earlier in his DDD article, notes this in regard to this verse. He says, in Amos's vision of the plague of locusts, Amos 7:1, the Septuagint translator read Gog for Gimel, Zion, Yod, clippings or mowings, focusing on Gog as the leader of a threatening army represented by a swarm of locusts. Okay, that's loose quote. Now, here's me talking again. It's very hard to follow the logic of the Septuagint translator. The writers get, or the waters get muddied a bit more when we discover that the Septuagint translator arbitrarily transforms Og of Bashan in Deuteronomy 3, verse 1, verse 13, and Deuteronomy 4:47 to Gog in his translation. He adds a G. He adds a letter. Again, the Septuagint translator just adds a letter and changes the word. Even more confusing is the fact that at least one Septuagint manuscript of the same, you know, dealing with the same material, does the opposite. There's one Septuagint manuscript of Ezekiel 38:2 that instead of Gog, we have Og. So in one passage, Og becomes Gog. Another passage, Gog becomes Og in the Septuagint. This is the kind of thing I'm referring to, that you look at it and you go, you know what? They just didn't know what to do with this. It's just confusion. Now, one certainty arises out of this messiness. This is me in reversing Hermann again. At least some, here's the certainty, at least some Second Temple Jews were comfortable associating Gog with the giant of Bashan and Hermon and the great eschatological enemy. So at least one handful of Jewish people were writers. And of course, you know, their readers are going to go, you know, be influenced by what they write. But some of them were comfortable mixing all that stuff. And the question is, why? Why did they feel that that was okay? Or why did they feel that made sense? And I address this in Unseen Realm a little bit, but I'm going to continue reading and reversing Hermann as to why this is. And this is going to lead us to the end of this episode and transition to the next one. The real answer here, I think, the reason why they were comfortable, the Septuagint translators weren't bothered by what they were doing with the text, they were fiddling with the text, was because Gog for them was an enemy of the mythological, the mythic north. Again, taking north not just as a reference to geography, not just something up there geographically, but they associated the northern location in earthly geography with the dominion of Baal, okay, with the dominion of darkness, with dark powers cosmically. So we leave literal geography and we go to cosmic geography. That's what we mean by mythic geography, something that's supernatural in focus. And if you think that way, then you are in the territory of Baal and Mount Hermon and the Watchers and the Giants. So they were thinking on these terms. And there were good reasons, not just contrived reasons, why they were thinking on these terms. So they may have fiddled with the names Og and Gog in different passages or just not known what to do with them. But they were doing it because other things that are actually in the biblical text sort of legitimized it for them. Now, what am I talking about here? Okay, reversing Hermann here. I have a little section on Gog and the mythic supernatural north. In terms of physical geography, the region of Bashan constituted the northern limits of the promised land. Biblical people, of course, knew that there were enemy cities and peoples beyond Hermon. It is of no small consequence that when enemies from these northern regions invaded the land of Israel, they came, quote, from the north, from Tsaphon. The physical north, therefore, was associated with the terror of tyrants bent on Israel's destruction, because Israel got invaded from the north all the time. It was a scary thing. Next paragraph. The tyrant from the north factor is one of the reasons why Antiochus IV, and this takes us into part two where we're going to go with that, this factor is one of the reasons why Antiochus IV has become the prototype for the final end times Antichrist. Antiochus IV, whose violent career tracks closely with events of Daniel 8 through 11, was ruler of Seleucid Syria, just north of Bashan. It was he who invaded Jerusalem in the Second Temple period and forced Jewish priests to sacrifice unclean animals on the temple altar, and saw himself as an exalted deity. It is therefore understandable that a figure like Gog, the invader from the uttermost parts of the north, is how Ezekiel phrases it in Ezekiel 38:6 and 15 and chapter 39, verse 2. It's very understandable that a figure like Gog is viewed by scholars as a foreshadowing, okay, of Antiochus, Antiochus comes later than Ezekiel's time. Antiochus comes in the period between the Testaments. So when Antiochus shows up and does what he does, it naturally would have made people think of Gog, because Antiochus came from the north and did all these awful things. Back to reversing Hermon, next paragraph. But these observations merely scratch the surface. There's much more to see. As readers will recall, Bashan was the land of the Rephaim, the region associated with gateways to the realm of the dead and home to the city of Dan, the central cultic site for the worship of Baal, the lord of the underworld. The foot of Mount Hermon overlapped the northern boundary of the region of Bashan. As I wrote in the Unseen Realm, so here I put a little Unseen Realm into reversing Hermon. As I wrote in the Unseen Realm, quote, the word north in Hebrew is Tsafon or Zaphon in some transliterations. It refers to one of the common directional points, but because of what Israelites believed lurked in the north, the word came to signify something otherworldly. The most obvious example is Bashan. We've devoted a good deal of attention to the connection of that place with the realm of the dead and with giant clan populations like the Rephaim, whose ancestry was considered to derive from enemy divine beings. Bashan was also associated with Mount Hermon, the place where in Jewish theology the rebellious sons of God of Genesis 6, infamy, descended to commit their act of treason. But there was something beyond Bashan, farther north, that every Israelite associated with other gods hostile to Yahweh. Places like Sidon, Tyre, and Ugarit lay beyond Israel's northern border. The worship of Baal was central in these places. Specifically, Baal's home was a mountain, now known as Jebel el-Akhra, situated to the north of Ugarit. In ancient times, it was simply known as Tsafon, Tsapanu in Ugaritic. It was a divine mountain, the place where Baal held council as he ruled the gods of the Canaanite pantheon. Baal's place was thought to be on the heights of Tsapanu in Ugaritic texts. Baal is lord of Tsafon in the same sources. He is also called a prince, which is Zebul in Ugaritic. So you have Baal Zebul, Prince Baal. Again, we know what that's going to evolve into. It's going to become a title for Satan. Another of Baal's titles, again, is Prince Lord of the Underworld, Zebul Baal Arts. Okay, Baal is Lord of the Dead, Lord of the Underworld. It is no surprise, then, that Zebul Baal becomes Baal Zebul and Baal Zebub, which was actually a term of derision. These titles were associated with Satan in later Jewish literature and the New Testament. So it isn't just the New Testament. That's the end of the Unseen Realm quote. An ancient reader would therefore, back to reversing Hermon, an ancient reader would therefore not only have feared the north because of the threat of invading tyranny, but for supernatural theological reasons. This is the conceptual grid among or through which Gog of Magog must be understood. The failure to find any secure historical referent for Gog, and the fact that the far north from which Gog hailed was so clearly associated with dark supernatural powers, has led many scholars to consider Gog as a supernatural terror instead of a historical person. This trajectory is, in fact, more coherent. Several scholars have proposed that Gog could be viewed as a personification of darkness, based on the meaning of the Sumerian Gug, which means darkness. This view has found little acceptance, but its detractors have offered next to nothing in the way of evidence for rebuttal. A supernatural figure of darkness actually comports well with Revelation 20, verses 7 through 10, which mentions Gog and Magog along with Satan and the human armies arrayed against Jerusalem, the holy city. That's the end of the Hermon excerpt. Now, I'm just going to summarize this because this is going to bleed into what we're going to do in part two, and that is interpretation. So by way of summary for this episode, a couple points, 5 points. Number one, the geographical references in Ezekiel 38 and 39 are clear. This is not modern Russia. The place names are all found in Anatolia, ancient Asia Minor. You could throw in the Greek Isles, okay? Greek Isles and modern Turkey, if you want a modern geographical referent, you know, for familiarity. It's all familiar. Number two, Rosh is not a place name. This passage is not about Russia. There was no place name Rosh in antiquity. Three, as all the place names are from the north, the invasion of Gog is best understood as a cosmic invasion. That is, it would have been associated with dark powers or invaders who were a threat because supernatural forces of evil were empowering them. Fourth, as we'll see next time and hinted at here, this is the way the passage was understood by John, the book of Revelation, and other Second Temple writers. Human forces from the bad place, the north, the geographic north, which was under the dominion of supernatural powers, because it was the cosmic north. Okay, these were the enemies. The place from which they came was under dominion of Baal, the Lord of the Dead, who was the Satan figure. And lastly, number five, this is why it's misguided to look for a specific modern political entity for Gog. The idea is a Satan-empowered threat who seeks the inheritance of Yahweh, that is Jerusalem and Zion, for his own, and thus for his God, who is Satan, whether the figure in question recognizes that or not. So stay tuned for part two.
All right, Mike, I've got nothing really to comment on part one. I'll wait for part two, but I'm looking forward to part two.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting stuff. Again, I'm not going to, you know, I wanted to throw that in again, just so it's on the record, so to speak. And if you want sources for all that and you want more detail and more content, you know, Reversing Hermon does have a chapter that Gog and Magog is part of the discussion. So people can go there if they want more than, you know, what we just got on the podcast. But there's a lot of interesting stuff there. There really is.
Yeah. Don't forget, you can get that Tanner's article too on the episode page, as well as that map. So please go to thenakedbiblepodcast.com and get those extra resources. And Mike, mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. We'll patiently wait for part two. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.